Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today on Venus Rising, we welcome Michelle, a 34-year-old detransitioned woman. Michelle identified as transgender for a period of 10 years, during which time she was prescribed testosterone and underwent two medically unnecessary surgeries. 7 years after being prescribed testosterone, at nearly 30 years of age, she was diagnosed with ASD, ADHD, and post-traumatic stress disorder. She detransitioned a few years later. In the aftermath of her transition, Michelle began to question why she'd be encouraged to pursue an extreme medical treatment that ultimately wasn't right for her. She became particularly concerned that the affirmation approach by professionals left no room to consider developmental dysphoria, and her underdiagnosed disabilities contributed to her experience. Michelle considers writing to be her primary passion in life and is currently working on her first book. But in the meantime, she blogs about her post-transition experiences on her Substack titled Some Nuance, Please, and we'll include the link for that later. Michelle, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to chat with me and to talk with us at Venus Rising.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So you're quite active on Twitter, and that's how I found out about your story. So for listeners who might not be on Twitter or aren't aware of your story, I'd like to start back at the beginning and just kind of go through your personal story and what you feel like comfortable to share. We can start with kind of what your life was like before you started transition, and then what kind of, you know, what prompted this thought that maybe you were a man trapped in a woman's, or a man trapped in a woman's body.
Yeah. Okay. So we could start with my childhood. I think it was pretty normal up until the time that I switched schools. So in elementary school, around grade three, I switched schools. Mm-hmm. And before that point, things were okay. It's not like I was like the most popular kid in class or anything. But I mean, I'd grown up with everyone. I had my own friends and so on. But when I switched schools in grade three, I was put into a class with like people in my neighborhood who specifically didn't like me. So like I had bullies before then, but they were all just like neighborhood kids. We weren't in the same school. And then anyway, when I switched schools, that's when bullying started and was really, really intense in my life from pretty much grade three all the way to grade eight. So The formative years of like puberty and all of that was just a lot of people convincing me that I was like a gross and disgusting thing that needed to be avoided at all costs. And my self-esteem got really, really low during that period of time. When I finished grade eight, we graduated into high school, of course. And in high school, I did have like a group of friends. So that was pretty good. A lot of the kids that I had grown up with, though, were still on like the same school bus as me. So there were still some bullying going on, but by that time I'd sort of like created my own coping mechanism for it. I just had like first a Walkman and an MP3 player later on, but I had that with me all the time, just headphones on all the time, so that I just didn't hear anybody and just zoned out my entire bus trip. So that was sort of like early me teaching myself that escapism will get me what I want, which becomes a theme in my life, basically. So high school, and then out of high school, before high school ended, I started dating someone. The relationship ended up being kind of emotionally abusive. He was very controlling. He had his own stuff going on, which is no excuse, but I get it in retrospect. But I left high school early. I had enough credits to pass, so I have a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. I did sort of leave a couple months early and moved out. I lived with him for 2 years. and then came back, eventually decided that we needed to break up. And then I moved home with my parents. I got a job and then moved into Toronto. So this is where the transition stuff starts.
Okay.
Yeah.
And before this, you had supportive parents, you had stable home like that. You felt supported in your own home.
Yeah. I think my parents were, the impression I get from them as I was growing up is that they were very stressed out. Mm. So it's not like it was, everything was perfect at home. I think it felt very tense often. And not just because of like their working class or anything, but also because like my brother and sister had their own problems. I had my problems being bullied, and it was just a lot of things that were going on, but otherwise normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I moved to Toronto. I think I was still living with my parents when I announced that I was going to start transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
And what led me to that was, after I was out of this relationship, I started looking into my sexuality, and I was thinking that I might be asexual because for whatever reason, I just never wanted to have sex with him. And that was actually a repeat pattern in like with everyone I had seen before then, that I just didn't really want to, just very low libido, just wasn't interested sort mm-hmm. of thing. So I started looking into that, and I was on a forum, an asexual forum, and there were a lot of people talking about gender on the forum. So that's sort of where I was introduced to the idea. And then more of that idea and talking about transgender and stuff started showing up on Tumblr. I started using Tumblr around that time as well. And so between those two things, I sometimes talk about how there was this one post on the forum in which someone asked, have you ever questioned your gender in your lifetime, basically? And so everyone was answering the question, and I answered it by saying like, I'm a woman and I've never thought about anything else. And then like right after I hit send, there was like this thing in my brain going, but why have you never questioned it before?
And like then, as if you should have, like we should.
Yeah, exactly. And it feels silly in retrospect, but like that's just how it got in there. The idea was in there, and it was just like, why haven't you though? Like, because in my childhood, I was sort of gender nonconforming. I like, I don't know. I felt like a lot of the things that I liked were more in common with things that like my brother liked, for example.
Sure.
So video games and the music that we listened to, stuff like that I had a lot in common with him. So anyway, so I would look back on that and think, okay, so I had a sort of gender nonconforming childhood. So why have I never questioned my gender before? And then I guess it sort of rolled from there, snowballed. Yeah.
Can you explain really quickly? Because I think a lot of people get hung up on this, but your story kind of brings the point up that there's a difference between like sexuality and like gender identity. And I think a lot of people who don't spend time in this space or talking to these people who have experienced this, like they don't understand, you know? So could you talk a little bit about the differences and why that's important?
Yeah. So like sexuality is who you're attracted to. And then gender identity is supposed to be someone who you are, like the essence of who you are. And it doesn't, I'm thinking about it now, and just because I have such a hard time describing gender identity now, just because I don't believe it exists anymore. Like, so how do I word it back in the way that I would have worded it 10 years ago? But like one of the things that people used to say is sexuality is who you go to bed with and gender is who you go to bed as.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was their way of explaining it. But I think one of the reasons it showed up specifically on the asexuality forum, because there is an overlap between people with low libido that are traumatized or are asexual, and are autistic specifically. There was a lot of people on there that were autistic, and so it doesn't really surprise me that there was a lot of overlap with gender identity stuff as well. So it was arbitrary, the fact that gender was there, but also it was because there was such an overlap that a lot of people were interested in talking about it.
So you go online, you start exploring this, you start thinking, oh, okay, maybe this is me. Then what?
I guess it sort of sat in my mind for a while, but as another part of it was that as I started hanging out more with my friends, I started, I sort of moved to Toronto, but I still like lived at home sometimes. So that's why in my head, I'm just trying to remember the timeline exactly. But I was like experimenting with like buying men's clothes, which was just like cargo shorts. So it wasn't really like I'm walking around in formal men's clothes or anything. Right. So just sort of in a style that's more masculine, I guess. And so sure. I was experimenting with like my expression at the same time. And how does that feel? And I did cut my hair slightly shorter. So it was like shoulder length at one point before I ended up like chopping it all off. So there was sort of me exploring it in real life and then thinking about it online and blogging about it a little bit. And I remember writing something like, I like to look like a man, or I like looking like a boy, but I don't want to be one. And then 17 months later, I was on testosterone.
Wow.
So it was a really quick from there. And it was probably, it was less than a year from the time I said that I decided that I was going to go on it.
Yeah. So what happened in that time, in that year? What was the big shift?
I think it was really because I moved to Toronto. And then I was like, all right, I'm actually going to start my life now. Because what happened was I left high school. I moved across the country. All of my other friends went to university. So mm-hmm. I didn't have the same experience that they all did. I just sort of like went over here and did my thing and then came back. And now I'm just like, okay, let's try again. So I moved to Toronto. I had gotten into university. I was in university for 2 months before I got extremely depressed, started having suicidal ideation, and then I dropped out and then got on antidepressants for the first time. So
how old were you? About like 20, 19, 20?
I was 21.
21.
Yeah.
Have you had any, like, even with the bullying, any depression or suicidal thoughts before, or was this kind of the first time you were experiencing this?
Yeah. So I didn't bring it up, but the first time I self-harmed, I was 11. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like a one-off incident, but then it came back when I was about 14 or 15 and then was semi-regular, just sort of like a coping strategy for dealing with really, really intense emotions for maybe 15 to 20 years after that.
Yeah.
Which brings us to like almost today. Yeah. So that was something that was consistent throughout my life also. Yeah. So that was sort of what went wrong in that period of time, was that I wasn't able to make university work. I'd had a couple other relationships. The last one that I had before that was only 6 weeks long. And it was a really weird one where I felt like he was into me, but at the same time, it felt like he just was not into me, but he kept coming out of his way to see me. But so it was really confusing for me. And then 6 weeks in, he broke up with me. Just sort of, it felt very sudden, although it shouldn't have felt sudden. So like, it was a really confusing time basically where I was like, why isn't this working? And I think what happened was I latched on to the idea of transition being the solution to all of the problems, is that for whatever reason, my life isn't coming together because I haven't transitioned yet.
And was that idea, because I've talked to some folks, and that idea seems to have come from online, being online, you know, the encouragement from online folks. Is that, did that just kind of originate in your mind?
I don't know if it was like necessarily people directly encouraging me, but mm-hmm. it was seeing the information and lining up it up with my own life every single day. So just seeing, there would be like lists of different ways that gender dysphoria presents, but it would be stuff like so very broad, like you don't feel like you fit in, or you're even things like you're having trouble with classes. Like it's just this really broad stuff that could be anything. But if it's all of these things, and maybe you're just transgender, so it was not really telling me personally, but it is like, it's like putting that thought into your head.
Sure. No, that makes sense. You know, if you see it enough and you're experiencing all of these things, which, like, listeners to know, most of us have trouble with classes and have trouble fitting in. But okay. So what you decide, transgender, this is for me. And do you start seeing a therapist? How do you get about getting testosterone or knowing that that's what you want your next step to be?
Right. So at this time, I did have a regular therapist already.
Oh, okay.
Not like a gender therapist, just sort of someone I was seeing even before I was on the antidepressants. So like, I think I had been seeing her for maybe like, it was less than a year, I think, when I first decided that I wanted to go on antidepressants. So this is like 2009. So I was seeing her. I did sort of come out to her, I guess, also the same time I came out to my parents. So like, this was 2009 when I decided to go on antidepressants. 3 months later, I decided that the way I phrased it to myself is that I am a female to male transsexual. I didn't say transsexual, but I said I was like a genderqueer FTM. That's what I called myself at that time. So I guess that was my way of saying that I'm trans and I'm going to transition. And then, so that was December 2009. A couple months later, I told my parents, I told my therapist. And then in, I think, the spring of 2010 is when I went to a support group for people who are thinking about transitioning. And that was run by two therapists who are also trans. And during that sort of 12-week period, they gave a lot of information, a lot of pamphlets, a lot of handouts, websites, resources. But one of those sessions, I guess, they said that they had a connection with a nearby clinic that wanted one male and one female patient. They wanted to their resident doctors to have experience prescribing hormones, I think it was, specifically with transgender healthcare, whatever it was. I think it was specifically they wanted to prescribe hormones. But at any rate, one of those therapists wrote my letter, basically. So I had what was called a hormone readiness assessment with him, and that was less than an hour long. And then he wrote a letter recommending testosterone, and I got in contact with that clinic. So that's how that started.
In our, in the new film that we just came out with, Detransition Diary, Saving Our Sisters, that it's like crazy how easy it is to get letters and for testosterone, for surgery, which we'll talk about with you, but it's just mind baffling. Did your therapist that you were seeing for everything else, did she ever have anything to say about this? Or was she kind of like, go see a gender therapist, go to this and wash your hands free? Or like, what was her thought about all this?
So I actually needed a letter from her also.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I got the referral to the clinic, and this was like a general practitioner. So it wasn't actually like a gender clinic. It was just sort of a regular family doctor. And they told me they wanted a second letter of recommendation from my other therapist, the one that I was regularly seeing, and apparently to ensure that I was of sound mind to make the decision. So she wrote that letter for me also.
Did you feel like you were of sound mind?
In retrospect, no.
But at the time?
At the time, yes. But people who are delusional don't think they're delusional.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So you've gotten two letters. So did you end up going then to the clinic where they had residents who wanted to prescribe it then? Or did you just stick with the general practitioner?
Yeah. So there was a resident doctor there who did that. She wasn't there for very long, or I didn't see her for very long. So whoever was supervising her became my family doctor.
Okay.
after she left. And I think it was only a few months. I don't remember her at all, to be honest. Yeah.
So you've got your two letters and now they're prescribing you testosterone. What was it like at first? Did you have, you know, some gals say it's very euphoric feeling. They felt like their depression went away. Others, you know, very angry or hostile. Like, what was it like for you? Any side effects, complications?
I never noticed anything with my mood. But I think that could be because I'm just a very moody person in general. I guess I wasn't tracking it very well. So I didn't notice anything with my mood. The things that I noticed were acne, which got really terrible really quickly, enough that I actually went off testosterone about 5 months in. Mm. I went off so that I could go on Accutane. Mm-hmm. And I did like the full round of Accutane, which is I think like 6 or 7 months, and then went back on testosterone. It did nothing. So I had acne the whole time. So that was the worst bit. I was also on antidepressants at the same time. So The other part I noticed was that I couldn't cry. And I think it's hard to know whether that was antidepressants or if it was testosterone. But I think both of them have that same effect. So it wouldn't matter which one I was on. But those are the big ones for me, besides all of the other, the regular changes, my voice dropped. It's about the same depth. Is the word depth? It hasn't dropped since about 10 weeks. So 10 weeks on testosterone, this is still what it sounded like back then. Gotcha. So that's where it was, when it became permanent, basically. Although sometimes I'm speaking and it does sound a bit higher. And besides that, then just facial hair. And then like fat distribution and so on, which, all that sort of changed after I came off of it.
When you were on it, other than the acne and wanting to get that under control, did you feel like this was still the right call? Any doubt planted at that point, or you just felt like how was your suicidal ideations and depression? Did you feel like that was really well under control, or?
It's hard to say. When I first went on testosterone, my living situation was I was living with 7 other people.
Wow.
And one of them was pregnant at the time, so it was just like this house full of hormonal rage, I guess, kind of thing.
And there's a lot going on when you're around that many people in your 20s. It's a lot.
Yeah. And so I had to leave that house early just because I was so stressed out. But so I'm trying to remember what the question was initially.
Just how you were feeling with being on testosterone, because you were on it for quite a while then, right? Like, how long ultimately were you on testosterone before deciding that surgery was your next step?
Before deciding surgery was the next step. I don't know. I had surgery 14 months after.
Okay.
So it was probably within 6 months, I was like, okay, yeah, surgery is the next step sort of thing. Probably even before I started, I kind of wanted to have surgery, but didn't know if I was like ready to keep moving forward. After I was in that in-between period, I did see another therapist who is also transgender. And so I think he counts as a gender therapist. And I don't remember if he wrote me the letter for the top surgery or not. But I was seeing him in sort of preparation for the possibility of having top surgery. So I think I had it decided pretty early.
Yeah. What was it like getting the letters for top and bottom surgery? Was it equally as easy as getting the testosterone letters?
I think so. For top surgery, I didn't need a letter. So I didn't have bottom surgery. I did have a hysterectomy, so it's kind of like a bottom surgery, but it's not a genital surgery. Gotcha. But it's a reproductive surgery.
Right.
But I didn't need a letter for that. I had sort of like an interview with a nurse who took down all of the information and then sent it to insurance to see if they would cover it. And they did. So that was all I needed.
Okay. So yeah. Let's talk about those surgeries. How'd your surgery go? You can talk about one or both of them at the same time, however you feel comfortable, and talk about side effects, complications, if there were any, just kind of about your surgical experience and life now.
Okay. The double mastectomy I had done in Florida at the time, this was, I had it booked in 2011. And at that time it wasn't covered by provincial insurance in Canada. It is now, but back then it wasn't yet. At that time it wasn't covered. So I was able to, said to myself, I'm going to pick whichever surgeon I think is going to do the best job. So I picked someone from Florida. I flew down there. I was there for a week. They did like a follow-up after a week. And then I came home. And I don't know. It was interesting. In retrospect, it's interesting that when I was down there, I'm pretty sure he said he does like two or three top surgeries a day. This was in just the beginning of 2012. So like, it was a booming business back then, which was surprising. There was another, someone was recovering in the same motel that I was in even. So there were no complications in terms of like the results. Like I'm 10 years down the road now. It's mostly fine because I mean, I've seen a lot of top surgeries and a lot of them I don't really like how they look. Mine is mostly fine, except that there was fat left in one side. So one side is slightly bigger than the other side. It's not even noticeable unless my shirt's off. You can kind of see it. There's like a concave, but yeah. So they're not symmetrical. So it's not like a great result, but, it is what it is, I guess. Yeah.
And how do you feel now? Now that you are a woman, identifying as a woman, how does having these operations affect how you feel about yourself?
It doesn't feel great, honestly, because when I think back on it, the way that I frame it in my mind now, like what I did to myself was that I was desperately trying to remove every bit of femaleness from my body. Like had my breasts removed, had my uterus cut out so that I wouldn't have periods anymore, so that I wouldn't have to have pap tests anymore. Like I just didn't want anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And looking back on it, it just feels really sad. And I kind of wish that like my professionals had seen it as sad rather than something to be like applauded, mm-hmm. celebrated. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird feeling. But like, I feel like I've come to terms with my chest for the time being, I guess. Like because I didn't regret it for 8 years, I feel like at the 8 year mark, there is only so much feelings that I can have about my chest after that period of time, just because I'm so far from it and I'm sure. So used to it already.
Sure.
There's only so much mourning I can do for it.
Yeah.
Just because I'm so used to it the way it is now, I guess.
And that makes sense. You've lived in this body now and accepted it. So any like what have been like, so you have a hysterectomy and you're fairly young. Any complications or health concerns now that you're living with that? Or,
I mean, the not being able to have children part is a complication. I think I started talking about wanting children only a year after the hysterectomy. And that was still a year before I detransitioned. So I was already thinking about it pretty shortly after. And then in the 2 year mark, it got like a lot worse where I was just like, I really, really feel like I should have had children. I shouldn't have done this. And then I think the first 6 months after I detransitioned were probably the worst, because at that point I had come to, I guess, the understanding that it was medically unnecessary and that like, I was never going to be able to carry my own children. Probably never have children at all. I still have ovaries. That's why there's like that weird possibility, but it just feels like there's too many. At any rate, another woman would need to be involved, and it just feels like something that I'm not sure can be done ethically. So
yeah,
it's difficult. There's just too many things to think about. So it's probably not going to happen. But anyway, yeah. So the first 6 months after detransitioning, after being like, I realized I was a woman the whole time, I realized this whole thing was a giant mistake. I think that was when it was the hardest to deal with. And now I'm just sort of, I guess, coming to terms with it for now. But I feel like it's probably something's going to come up again, like when I get into a relationship and that comes up. So it's probably something that will keep coming up. But in terms of like other like surgical complications, not really. I feel like they should have told me. There were two sort of major possible complications that nobody told me about. And one of them was prolapse. So like your uterus really holds up all of the other organs that are in that area. So if it's not there, then they have the possibility of falling out. And that didn't really get mentioned. The other thing that didn't get mentioned was early onset dementia. And that runs in my family. Early onset doesn't run in my family, but Alzheimer's does, and dementia. So that scares me also. And I already have like memory issues. So it scares me. It scares me enough that like I've had nights where I'm just like, oh my God, do I have early symptoms? And just sort of like a hypochondriac, I'm not sure sort of thing, but yeah.
But nobody told you about that. And did anyone discuss your fertility with you? Or like, I mean, it's obvious, right? You're like, oh, you're taking out your uterus. But did anyone have like a real discussion about the magnificence of that decision?
No, not in that way. I think there is a possibility that we talked about options, but I really do think that like it should have been something that would have was talked about in an emotional way and not in like a practical way. But I just never had that opportunity as part of the process. So,
yeah. And you were, I just want to drill this home because you bring up a really important point. And Grace in our film also brings this up about her fertility and having children. And you're older, like we're in your 20s at this point, right? And so I just think about going back to kids who this is happening to, and they're taking away their potential fertility. And these are kids like in your 20s, you still don't know if you want kids sometime. So let alone when you're 12, 14, 16, you know? I get so frustrated.
Yeah, no, me too. And I'm very worried about it, about just, yeah, that whole situation. But even in my situation, I wanted children all the way up until I transitioned. And then 5 years into transition, I didn't want children anymore. And that lasted for like a period of like 3 or 4 years when I was extremely depressed. And then as I was coming out of it, suddenly I wanted children again. So it's like it got in sucked in. It's just like it was bad timing or something, but
it
shouldn't have been made so easily. It shouldn't have been easy right. to make the decision.
I can't imagine anyone who is depressed thinking that about a future with children and a family, right? Like, you know, that's probably not on your radar anyway, but how did transition, did you feel like, so I'm going to get into the fact that, you know, studies show that transition decreases suicide and kids who don't get to transition are going to commit suicide. And you here have some experience, I feel like, or you're able to talk about this because you did have those feelings and you did have some depression. Did any of that get worse or better during your transition and then into detransition? Or can you speak to that kind of claim at all?
It is hard to say because I feel like all of my feelings were so much more intense before I transitioned. And then, or you could also say all my feelings were so much more intense before I was ever on antidepressants because I was on antidepressants for a lot of those years also.
Sure.
So it really like took off the edge. And so there were a lot of times where instead of being suicidal, it was more, I just don't want to do anything ever. And just, I just want to be in my bed and do nothing. Mm. And that got worse for sure. So I might have not been like actively trying to hurt myself anymore, although I was sometimes, but for the most part, it was just sort of all of my motivation to do anything died. And I just didn't want to participate in the world. I just didn't want to be around people. That got huge, basically. So I wasn't more suicidal, but I was more like hopeless. So it's losing the will to live, but not wanting to kill yourself. Mm. So yeah.
And that was going on during your transition is what you're
during the transition.
Want to make sure. Okay.
Yeah. Particularly. So I went off testosterone in 2016, which is 4 years before I detransitioned. So I was on it for in total about 4.5 years over a 6 year period. Mm-hmm. I went off and on it. And the time that I went off, there was a few months that I had that were really good, but then I was depressed again. But before that point, I was also depressed. It was really just sort of cycling over and over, but the depression itself got worse during that period of time. And after I went off testosterone, basically all the way until I detransitioned.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? Let's talk about that then. Why off testosterone and then a wait time until you detransitioned? And what was it that made you think like, okay, this didn't work, or whatever it is you thought that decided your trip to, or your journey through detransition?
Yeah. So I stopped testosterone because in part I stopped caring about masculinizing myself. And also in part, I was tired of having acne all the time. And also in part because I was having a really hard time taking all of my dosages on time. Mm-hmm. So I was supposed to take it every 2 weeks. The day would roll around and I would just be like, I'll just take it tomorrow. I'll just do the shot tomorrow. And I would end up taking it every 3 weeks instead. Mm. And I thought, it's probably not healthy. So I just stopped cold turkey and I started identifying as non-binary at that time instead. Mm-hmm. So I had those 4 years where I kept saying that I was trans. I was just non-binary now instead. I was someone who had transitioned and was about 95% of the time, everybody was just thinking that I was male that whole time. So I didn't make any efforts to like try and do anything different, except I started dyeing my hair a lot of random colors during that period of time. It might be like a non-binary rite of passage or something. For those 4 years, kept identifying as trans. For three of those years, I lived with someone who also identified as trans and also detransitioned. Hmm. So I think he really did influence me in a good way. We lived together for about 3 years. It was a really, really difficult 3 years. But in the last year, which was 2020, so the pandemic started and then he detransitioned. So he had been still on hormones at that time. So he stopped taking hormones. He had an orchiectomy, so he had to start taking testosterone. And he'll be on synthetic hormones for the rest of his life. And then he changed his name back and did everything. And I just watched him get more and more stable and just do better in general. And we had some talks about why he thought that he transitioned in the first place and who he thought might be liable, and you know, if whether he got pushed. He thinks his therapist encouraged him into it and stuff like that. And we had all those discussions. And then right at the end of 2020, I just had a moment where I was like, I feel like I miss the solidarity I had with other women. and I want that back. And I guess the understanding of I want that back to me meant it's because I'm a woman and I have been a woman the whole time. Yeah. And then Christmas sort of holidays started. So he left a couple weeks after I decided to detransition, he left. And then I'm in my house alone, just being like, okay, now I just have to process this. So yeah, that's what I did for the next couple of months, was just process everything.
Which is a lot to process.
Yeah.
Were you still seeing a therapist at this time? Like, still in the relationship with the therapist that you had before, as someone to kind of talk you through these things? Or
it was, I was seeing a different therapist. Ah. So the other therapist, I did see her for 10 years. So I had seen her probably until 2018, maybe 2019. And then in 2020, just before I decided to detransition, I started seeing a new therapist. And we never talked about it in any sessions. It just sort of came up completely separate. But so I couldn't say whether or not that sort of spurred me towards wanting to detransition, but it could have.
But it sounds like you were getting therapy that was like good, right? Like, it wasn't pushing you or not. It was just being helpful for you.
Yeah. We were talking about other things in my life, like my family and other areas of it. We weren't really talking about gender at all, I don't think. But yeah, it just sort of came up separately. And then the next time I was in therapy, I was like, so I think I'm going to change my gender back now. So
what did your therapist say? Or was he or she supportive of that? Or
yeah, she had no problem with it at all. She was just like, okay. And it was just really... The type of therapy it was it's called internal family systems, IFS. And it's very, I think you could say, client led, where it isn't maybe not led, but you're going into yourself and asking yourself questions and then sort of letting the answers just sort of come to the surface. And then you just listen to whatever your brain is telling you, that sort of thing. So it's not really her feeding me anything. It's really her asking questions about what my subconscious thinks, I guess. So in that sense, it's not really, she's not doing any affirming. I'm really just affirming myself, I guess. So, yeah.
So since that time, you've also been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you think that those played a role in your deciding to transition?
Yeah, I think it's they're basically the diagnosis that should have been made instead of gender dysphoria. So just all different parts of either those neurodevelopmental disabilities and sort of my complex childhood trauma sort of stuff, and just all of that together sort of made up why I felt uncomfortable in my body and why I came to the conclusion that if it's because I am not a woman, then I must be a man, basically, sort of thing. The black and white thinking and feeling very dissociated. So yeah, no, it's the narrative that I should have had. And if I had it, then maybe I would have gone down a different path. So yeah, I was diagnosed in 2017. So it was actually before the hysterectomy. So I needed to take 3 or 4 years to really process all of it and put everything together and realize that this was the alternative. This was the alternative narrative to this other narrative that I had, that I was born transgender, sort of thing.
So now what? I follow you on Twitter. You're pretty outspoken about this. What advice or what primary thing would you say to people who might be questioning, who might, either way, who might be wanting to think about transitioning or detransitioning. What do you want to say to those people?
It's hard to know what to say to someone who wants to transition, just because it feels like a lot of them have already decided that transition is the answer. Because I feel like that was the situation for me, was that I felt like it was the answer and then really clung on to it as the answer. And if no one else can give you an alternative answer, mm-hmm. then it's really hard to move away from the answer that you've already picked for yourself. So because that was part of the reason, because I didn't know that I had autism and ADHD and that all of these things from childhood trauma and so on, all of those things are affecting me, then how was I supposed to grab that narrative instead of the trans narrative? So it's hard to know what to say to a person because you need to give them the alternative narrative. But for people who are detransitioning, there's just so much. That's why I've gone silent, because I'm just there's so much to process about it. There's the fact that you might feel like you've done something that's self-harm and you want to know why everyone in your life was just sort of cheering you on through it. There's coming to terms with the fact that it wasn't just you that was wrong, it was everyone that was wrong. And like a lot of people that you trusted. And yeah. So in terms of advice, I don't want to say something that sounds too flippant, but just my thought is like, you need to go to therapy, but like people, you need to talk to other people mm-hmm. and really establish trust in yourself. You need to know what like abusive relationships look like. That was really important for me, was coming out and realizing that like the group dynamic around trans activism was really, really abusive. So in going back into a different type of activism/advocacy, I really, really needed to be aware of what to avoid and the types of people to avoid, so you don't sort of fall in and feel like you're just fighting with people all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I had something that was more specific, but
no, I think that's great. I think what I want is people to hear the stories of detransitioners, and it seems like we're getting more and more stories, more people who are experiencing this. Who do you think is liable for all of this?
Oh.
Or is there anyone?
So, like, I think that the people who are in positions of authority are liable for it, because they're the ones that are supposed to know better. So that's doctors, therapists, surgeons. Mm-hmm. are supposed to know better. It's like part of their professional obligation, I think. But if you want to know who's leading them, then it's activists also. So they're also liable in sort of like a sideways way, where they've been influencing people in positions of authority. But the problem is the people in positions of authority should know better.
They should hold the line, right?
Like, yeah.
Doctors are held to a code, and I feel like they should be holding the line. Like, no matter what a patient says, no matter what an activist says, like, if this is dangerous or we don't even know if it's dangerous, then they should hold the line, I feel like. And in my opinion, I haven't walked through this. So, you know,
they should be following the evidence, basically.
Yeah.
That's what should be. Always the most important thing is the evidence, and people should be able to talk about the evidence and offer different interpretations of the evidence. So, and that's just not happening right now. So
I'm hopeful. Are you hopeful though? I'm hopeful.
I am hopeful. I think I've seen things, they look like they're changing.
Yeah.
Slowly. Yeah.
I think it depends on the day. Like, I have to remain optimistic to do the work that we do, but some days I feel like I'm more hopeful than others, but today I'm hopeful.
Yeah. No, I'm hopeful too.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, Michelle, It's been really a privilege to talk to you. And I just want to say thank you. It's such a personal story. Mm-hmm. And is there anything that you'd like to add before we tell our listeners goodbye?
You put me on the spot here.
Sorry. I'm not trying to. We can follow, you know what? They can follow you on your Substack, right? And that is Some Nuance, Please. I'll provide the link in the description of this recording. And can you give your Twitter handle? Maybe we'll start there.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is also Some Nuance, Please. But that is too long to be the Twitter handle. So it's Some Nuance, PLS.
Okay.
Instead. Yeah.
But yeah, thank you for joining me today. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in and for listening to these stories. They are important, as our goal is, as ever, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you to think beyond the masses. Again, thank you so much, Michelle.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me again.
Of course.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.